I think it was Monday morning before I caught my breath. By then, distorted accounts of the incident had spread to the neighborhoods near the park as parents sought to separate truth from exaggerated adolescent fiction. Those who knew, those who ran when the terrifying headlights appeared, kept quiet, denying, if possible, that they were even there at the time. I didn't get caught. I ran fast, and I was smart, I suppose. Part one, the boys of summer. We were the baseball boys of East Memphis. We were Billy, Woody, Terry, Larry, Brig, Brett, Nubby, Tommy, Andy, Mike, Dave, Danny, et al. We played baseball after school, Saturday mornings, weekday mornings during summer vacations, Sunday afternoons, and once on a Sunday night. Once. If you know anything about Memphis, Tennessee, you know it's famous for cotton, music, barbecue, and southern hospitality that comes with a "be sure to use a coaster, hun." It's where Elvis lived and Martin Luther King died. It's where blacks and whites get along in the way quarreling siblings get along when mama's in the room. We lived in an all-white section of Memphis, many, many blocks from the neighborhoods you didn't want to get caught in after dark. Whatever happened in those neighborhoods stayed in those neighborhoods, unless they made headlines in the Commercial Appeal or the Press-Cimeter newspapers. We were isolated, and we preferred it that way. We were blissfully ignorant white kids. Our home turf was Sea Isle Park. Yeah, Sea Isle Park, only there was no sea and no island, unless you count the concrete pillar in the middle of the kiddie wading pool. Other city parks were named after civic leaders, explorers, or historical figures like Lincoln, Washington, Douglas, Marquette, or Carver. But for us, Sea Isle Park. By comparison, the Ball Diamond was really pretty good. It got a little dusty late in the summer, especially in the right-handed batter's box, but Park Service employees wetted it down as needed in preparation for the main event, adult softball games at night under the lights. We envied the softball teams with their uniforms and company sponsors, their shiny aluminum bats and the gleaming white baseball softballs they unboxed before each game. Those pearly white softballs looked like full moons on high fly balls. While the baseball field was ours during the daylight hours, we had to yield to the official league softball games at night. We still hung out there, though. Heaven knows there wasn't anything else to do after dark without a driver's license. We never mingled with the softball people. They were adults, except, of course, for the kids who spilled soda on their clothes and poured dirt out of snow cone cups. We just clustered by ourselves and talked about things. Girls, life at home, sports, girls, cars, and girls. We sometimes gathered in the outfield in the semi-darkness behind the light poles and taunted the outfielders. "Hey, left fielder, dog poop on your left." Wait, did I say left? I meant right. "Hey, left fielder, you're standing in it." One time an umpire grabbed a silver aluminum bat and charged towards us, yelling for us to get off the field. True, we were technically in fair territory, but we argued that any ball hit that far would surely be a home run unless the batter fell down 8 times while circling the bases. Nonetheless, the umpire insisted we move back, and we did. We were good kids. You tell us to move back, we move back. As the summer wore on and the notorious Memphis heat settled in for a long stay, our daytime pickup baseball games became less frequent and far less well attended. The dog days of summer were growling, and we were bored out of our minds. Until part two, the caper that began with the words, "It's not locked." "It's not locked," Billy said. "Looks like it's locked to me." "I know, but look, the lock has just closed on itself. You can open the door anytime you want." Now, the thing that wasn't locked was the electrical service box that fed the array of lights for the baseball diamond. Park employees must have left it unlocked to simplify things when softball teams showed up for night games. The significance of this discovery was at first lost to us, but soon an intriguing opportunity was presented. "So, anyone up for some night baseball?" Billy offered. Are you serious? Hell yeah, I'm serious. Come on, what's it gonna hurt? Our butts if we get caught. No one's going to care. That seemed to be the overwhelming reality that we eventually bought into. No one was gonna care. We weren't plotting a bank heist, a wave of civil disobedience, a riot, or even a cow tipping escapade. We just wanted to play baseball at night when it wasn't so dang hot. So it was on. The plan was to convene Sunday night when no league games were scheduled, turn on the lights, and play ball. Word was discreetly passed around to all of the regulars with an admonition to keep the plan a secret. As if turning on several kilowatts of powerful lights in a sedentary neighborhood on a Sunday night could ever remain a secret for long. There must have been 25 guys show up for the big game. Sides were drawn and the game began at dusk with the lights off. But by the third inning, the sunlight was all but gone and time had come to flip the switch. Billy did the honors, but the word was, no one knows who turned the lights on. Got it? Yep, got it. Bright lights chased the darkness away and brought the red dirt under our feet to life. Few of us had ever played baseball under the lights before, and now this was an adventure to relish. How cool was this? But there were drawbacks. The field lights were set for league softball games, played with big, new, gleaming white softballs that didn't go very far or fast when struck. We quickly discovered that our dingy aspirin pill baseballs often flew out of sight, either above or beyond the range of the light coverage. Hot grounders posed a similar set of issues as infielders had to account for the shadow racing across the dust. In time, we managed to lose all of our baseballs. We knew that we could easily retrieve them in the daylight of the next morning, but that put an end to our nocturnal baseball game unless we could stumble upon one of the lost orbs in the grass. We should have called it quits right then, or actually, well before then, but it was too late. Headlights on high beam. They surged inward from three separate vantage points with a beastly roar of eight-cylinder engines. As cars bounced over the uneven terrain, the headlights flared and shuddered like the eyes of a charging leopard, closing fast on a hapless antelope. It was the police, of course. In an instant, we scattered like roaches when the pantry light comes on. Only in this case, it was just the opposite. The lights went out, thanks to the first kid to get to the switch box. I sprinted in the direction of what we local kids called Monkey Mountains, a ravine with crooked, weedy ditches deep enough to crouch down in. We used to conduct trench warfare in those ditches, hurling dirt clods at the enemy combatants and watching yellow clouds of dust explode on impact. But tonight, in the sudden darkness, the Monkey Mountains became my refuge. Several other guys had the same idea, figuring that the cop cars would have trouble negotiating the ditches if they even came that way. And they didn't. The three squad cars converged just behind second base and settled. The officers got out and walked around, aiming flashlight beams across the grass. And when one swung in our direction, someone yelled, "Duck!" Perhaps a little too forcefully. One of the cops called out, "All right, who's over there?" We didn't answer. But if knocking knees were audible, it would have sounded like rocks rattling inside a tin bucket. "Come on, boys, get up. Game's up, let's go." We wanted to get it over with, come out with our hands up and admit to our foul, no baseball pun intended, deeds. But defying our impulse to do the right thing, we crouched lower in the ditches, our sweat making mud with the dust. After a few heart-pounding minutes that seemed like hours, we heard voices again, but they were more distant than before. And we heard other voices, younger voices, scared voices. They caught some of the guys. Oh, crap. While the police's attention was diverted, we made a dash for the park's eastern boundary, miraculously avoiding countless ankle-spraining hazards in the dark. Once we reached the sidewalk along a state drive, we felt safe from persecution. Suddenly, we were just kids walking down the street. who appeared out of nowhere with baseball gloves tucked under our arms and mud on our skin. Of the 25 kids or so on the field when the squad cars charged, only five or six were unlucky enough to get caught, and even they were let go after a few minutes of terror. Perhaps the officers were lenient because it wouldn't be fair to stick those few kids with the consequences when so many others had gotten away. Plus, once they determined that we hadn't broken the lock on the light switch, what could they charge anyone with anyway? It wasn't against the law to be a stupid white kid. For nearly all of us, that was the worst trouble we would ever be in. And if you say, well, that's nothing, you'd be right.
Daniel, tell me about the origins of this story.
This is actually part of a much longer story that goes more into depth about talking about the neighborhood I grew up in and some of the less desirable neighborhoods in Memphis. This was in the summer of 1968, one of the most turbulent years in American history. And of course, at the time, we just really didn't know what went on in those other neighborhoods. So this was kind of just a demonstration of how protected and isolated we were, even in the same city where Dr. Martin Luther King had been killed and there had been trouble, and, you know, it was a troublesome year.
So did you have this sitting on the shelf, or did you for a while?
I have trotted it out a few times over the years. I never developed it to this extent, but, yeah.
Ever formally study writing?
Well, I have a communications degree from this fine institution. I must say the elevators seem faster in this
than what I recall.
Do you still write on a regular basis?
Yes, I do. I used to be Clark Kent. To be honest with you, for 10 years I was the mild-mannered reporter for the Metropolis Planet in Metropolis, Illinois. And that was a fun gig. It really was. But I write so that maybe somehow when I get old, my brain will still be sharp.
And is there an author or a book that you particularly enjoy?
Louis Grizzard.
Nice.
Dave Barry, snarky Southern guys. I grew up right in the middle of William Faulkner country. But I can't get through a paragraph of his without going, wait, what? those snarky Southern writers is my favorite.
Now you've got Faulkner spinning in his grave. Daniel Milam, thank you very much.